Hello and welcome everyone to the Institute for Government. My name is Hannah White and I'm Director of the IFG. I'm delighted that today we are holding this In Conversation event with Alex Chisholm, Chief Operating Officer for the Civil Service and Permanent Secretary of the Cabinet Office, who of course is stepping down from those roles in a few weeks. Thank you to everyone who's joined us here in the room for this event and for those of you who are joining online. I'll be putting plenty of questions to Alex, but then there'll be an opportunity for you to ask your questions. If you're here in the room, we'll do that with a microphone. If you're joining online, please do send in your questions via Slido, and I will be taking some of those questions via my iPad. We'll also be live tweeting from IFG events using the hashtag civil service. So please do follow and tweet along. So before we begin, a little introduction to Alex. He's, as you will all no doubt know, been COO of the Civil Service and PermSec of the Cabinet Office since April 2020, almost 4 years, and a fairly eventful 4 years at that for the Civil Service. He was previously Permanent Secretary of the Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy and the Department for Energy and Climate Change, and before that, Chief Executive of the Competition and Markets Authority. He started his career as an official, but then also worked in the private sector before returning to the civil service. And in his current role, has driven several areas of civil service reform, championing the relocation of officials outside of London, as well as embedding the functional agenda, something we care about a lot here at the IFG, and improving digital and data skills in the civil service. And in November, he announced he'd be stepping down at the end of his term next month. So we're delighted to have the opportunity to talk to him today. Welcome, Alex. So, first of all, it would just be really interesting to hear your reflections on 4 years in these really crucial roles for the civil service.
Great, thanks, Hannah, and afternoon, everybody. And really appreciate the IFG hosting this event, and indeed, with the week we've had, also a massive report earlier in the week. Really good to get your external view about what we could be doing differently and better. And we'll perhaps come on to that later. But just reflecting, as you say, on the 4 years, you mentioned I started April 20, and of course that was the beginning of lockdown. So starting at the Cabinet Office at that time was remarkable and bizarre, I must say. And I think when we look back on this era, quite aside from all the other things that have been happening, the three dominant things will be undoubtedly Brexit, the COVID response, and war in Europe. Obviously, all of those have their own kind of ongoing ramifications. But I particularly want to maybe just to call out on COVID, because I think that quite a lot of the media environment of late has been quite critical. Obviously, that's some of the tone coming from the independent legal inquiry, and having sort of lived the dream. I think what hasn't been recognised enough is that civil servants, not only in my own department, but right across government and public servants, did extraordinary things in response to COVID to help save people's lives and livelihoods. And if those things hadn't been done, we'd have been much worse off. And I think there hasn't been perhaps quite enough recognition and appreciation for that.
And as I said, you have a successor now, Cat Lith, mm-hmm. has been announced. What would your advice be to her after your having had 4 years in the role? And I guess, what do you wish you knew when you began the role?
I was actually with a group of colleagues last night marking my departure, and one of them said the advice I gave to her when she joined number 10 was that what was needed was relentless optimism. So I was quite pleased to be reminded of that, because I do think that is a good quality to bring, both the optimism, because we all believe in a better world, we need to take the chance we have in government to try and bring that about, but also the relentlessness, because if at first you don't succeed, try again. Sometimes it is 3 steps forward and 2 steps back, occasionally the other way around. I've had days like that too. You need to stick at it. You need to remember that it's a big and powerful and complicated system, so bringing about change within it is not easy, but it is very worthwhile. And that when you can achieve that collaboration, you can line up people's incentives, you can get people to see that's where we're moving towards and move in that direction. It's also immensely powerful and makes a huge difference to everybody across the whole country, so very worthwhile. Within that, the things that I think that are most important from a value perspective, first of all, around the making sure that we remain in touch with communities across the whole country and don't fall into any aspect of kind of Whitehallism. You know, we're in London today, but the civil service is mainly not in London, and we've made great progress, I think, in the last 4 years through the Place for Growth programme in transferring roles across the whole of the UK, creating 15 vibrant hubs in places where there used not to be many civil servants, towns like, or cities like Wolverhampton, Darlington, places like Glasgow, where there were a lot of civil servants. We had just two there when I started, and Michael Gove was our Chancellor. The Dutch Lancaster then challenged us to set up a second headquarters in Glasgow. We now have 560. And a very different group of people we have there, bringing a very different perspective from different backgrounds, really strongly embedded in their communities as well. I think that is a very important dimension, so we want to carry on with that, take it further still. Secondly, I would pick out digital and data. That's the kind of the most important area of change, both in wider society, we know that in all of our personal lives and business lives, as well as in government. But also in government, it's got the best prospect for transforming people's experience of services, the cost of delivering those services, the timeliness, the ability to customize that. All of that is there in the capability of the technology and the systems we use and the data breakthroughs that have been achieved. We now need to get very good at using that in government. And if we do, we'll do an amazing job for citizens and they will be surprised on the upside by what they're getting from government.
Great. So those are things you would urge CAT to press on with, essentially?
Yes.
Okay.
Probably also just one, you know, maybe two other things now you mentioned it. The partnership with the political system, I think, is really important. When we set out on the kind of reform journey in 2020, that was one of the things we looked in the past and seen what can go wrong is either when it seems to be a political initiative, which the civil service is a bit kind of like a little tiny bit half-hearted about, or when the civil service is doing it for itself and the politicians are like, hang on, we're in charge here, you know, we control resources and everything like that, and we set the priorities. So it has to be in lockstep in that real kind of partnership mode.
Which is clearly easier if you have consistency of political leadership.
A fair observation.
Sorry, I interrupt. Second point.
And the other thing I think is that it does play a little bit to what I was saying about being able to operate across the whole UK, that, you know, we mustn't be sort of a small group of people at the centre trying to determine what's the best thing to do. I mean, that is the kind of, you know, the failure type within government from lots of different programmes and things in the past. So it's very important that we listen to what people across the whole of the civil service are saying, listen to what the users of public services are saying, and adapt ourselves to that. So we don't want to be too cabinet office-y or treasury or number 10-y about it. We need to make sure that we really make sure that it's... it reflects the real needs and priorities and can be delivered across the whole of the country.
What does that look like in practice, that listening? Like how, what have you seen that's successful or that you would like to see that would make a step change in that?
Yeah, so just give a few examples of that. So I remember being in Darlington and you know, I was there for a whole series of visits, but one of the other sort of events that were happening that day was the Treasury Labour Markets team, young group of brilliant people who had come to Darlington for the day, although a couple of them I think were located there, were meeting with people working in the local benefits office, not just civil servants there, but also people who were themselves going through work coaching, and they were having a workshop based on that about to try and understand better what it was that would induce people to come into the back into full-time work. That type of working is very different from sitting in one's office in Whitehall and saying, I think I know best, and you know, reading research. So it's much more community-based and much more kind of working across the disciplines. So I think that is a great example of it. We've also, the civil service is a pretty varied group of people. The difference between people working on policy with ministers or legislation and people working in border force or in benefits office, again, a huge difference. So when we were doing the second phase of our reform, Sapna and myself, calling out Sapna Agrawal in the audience here, did a kind of a roadshow. We traveled up and down the country and with the help of other colleagues as well, listened to the views of people at all different professions, functions, departments, grades, and that really helped us sort of see what matters to them. And some of those things were actually quite practical. I remember working in the Cabinet Office with some you know, digital experts and AI experts, etc. You know, I'm obviously very excited about that. But you know, it was sobering to find that in many of the big delivery departments, the big game changer had been having their own laptop, which they'd acquired because of lockdown. But actually, in comparison to the performance they were able to get from their work, that made a huge difference. Mm. And being able to access systems remotely, again, was hugely important for those departments. So, it's just another example. One shouldn't get too carried away with, if you like, the sort of cutting edge and the frontier possibilities, and just remember that the reality is good quality basic systems and facilities people are working in, and the training for them is incredibly important.
It reminds me of some of our work on public services, which has found that a step change could be created in the NHS by better use of the technology, which is the telephone.
Yeah, yeah.
Rather than anything more complicated.
Exactly, and then when we're talking about shared services across government and interoperability, which is again one of our big agenda items for change, people used to complain about the Wi-Fi. I've noticed that it's the absence of complaint is sometimes the sign that you've made progress, and that's 250,000 people a day are using Gov Wi-Fi across 274 locations. Seems to work pretty well. That's why the silence of contentment.
Something you have to chalk up as a win, absolutely. You kindly mentioned our report we published at the start of the week. You will have noticed, indeed, very helpful in helping us develop our thinking. It was pretty critical in the end about the Cabinet Office, and I was reflecting on the evidence you gave to PACAC, in which you said that you felt that there were benefits to the two parts of the Cabinet Office, essentially, that sit together, the secretariats and the more functional side, but also some costs. Mm-hmm. Just really interested in your reaction to the report as a whole, but in particular, obviously, the critique of our conclusion was that you ought to split up the Cabinet Office, take that functional side of it into a separate department where there could be a really strong focus on civil service reform and driving that and combine the secretariats with number 10.
Yeah.
Interested in your thoughts.
Great, yeah. So obviously it won't be for me to decide. Ministers will decide, and it won't be for me to implement either, because I'll be finished unless it happens in the next 3 weeks, which I think is unlikely.
you can always hope.
But a few things. First of all, it's great to have your report. I know you did a really deep study on that. Lots of excellent research analysis there, lots of consultation. Really, really good. Also wanted to call out some other good reports we've had as well from from Reform, from Francis Maud recently. Lots. So that is great. So good public reports, well-evidenced and researched, really adds to the quality of public debate and will enable whatever choices to be made to be well-informed and hopefully for the better. Second point I make is that quite a lot of what people want is actually changes in behavior and priority and culture, and you don't tend to achieve those just by structural change and moving things around, and the capabilities of the people they work on and what they're asked to work on, the facilities they have, are arguably more important than the institutional or organizational wrapper they work within. And moving things around is surprisingly expensive. You've written some great reports, just a couple of years ago, about tens of millions of pounds in direct costs with change to systems, etc., lining up policies for HR and what have you, but actually much bigger costs in terms of the kind of the impact on disruption, engagement, people's sense of identity, their worry about where they fit within the new organisation, the reputation of the organisation, all of that. So, be careful what you wish for. I think that, make sure that if you're making a change, you're really sure it's well thought through, it's going to be changed for the better, and you've got a very clear theory about why it would be better. Just moving it around or pushing it out of sight doesn't particularly help. Cabinet Office itself has got bigger, but one of the reasons it's got bigger is because lots of functions that used to be done elsewhere have been moved into the Cabinet Office. Not everybody may know that FastStream and HR used to be managed by HMRC. Property and commercial was part of the Treasury. Those things got moved into the Cabinet Office in previous years. Security vetting from MOD and from the Foreign Office, etc. So we've become a kind of a repository for things. And that has a benefit, I would say, in terms of doing things once well rather than many times over. That's a clear efficiency. Doesn't mean it has to be done in the Cabinet Office. And not all of that has to be done at the centre. So on the whole, I think you want to have quite a light centre that therefore is easy to operate in as a group of people who have a degree of mutual understanding and familiarity. Also one which is primarily strategic and calling other people to account rather than delivering a lot of services itself. And then the other thing I make is that if you compare the UK with other democratic countries, almost everyone's got a group of people around the top person, prime minister, president, whatever it might be called, in some kind of a kind of department. We call ours number 10. We're a bit unusual compared to some countries in having this apparatus of cabinet, but it's a UK feature. We like that, we want to support that. Almost, you know, all the better countries now, so more developed countries, would have crisis management capability at the centre. And I, you know, I think that is good. I wouldn't want it any other way. And as you know very well, Hannah, you know, crises, they do come thick and fast. And having good capability to both to anticipate those, to try and head them off and then deal with it when it comes upon you is pretty essential. So the more arguable point is probably around the sort of corporate functions. Obvious benefits and combining it together in terms of political alignment. You've said in your report it might be better off in a separate department, especially if you integrate that more closely with public expenditure, as happens in many other countries. So there are some clear choices there, but I'd be very keen that whoever makes those choices thinks it through very, very carefully and also involves staff very much in that, so that staff say, oh yes, at last, not, oh no, not again.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Well, I mean, as you imply, we at the IFG are normally the last people to advocate for machinery of government change. And I think one of the things we often observe is that because the civil service is very good at sort of smoothing over the pain of machinery of government change from the point of view of ministers, ministers don't often perceive the costs which are incurred.
Yep.
They say, no, it's fine when we did whichever change it was, when actually the civil servants have been experiencing more of the pain. So we would be the last to recommend it. I think what we were really struck by in a year of taking evidence from a whole range of different people was the consistency of the message that the current structures aren't working. And therefore, we were convinced that there was a need for change. And part of it is what you were saying exactly about the sense of identity. Yes, there's a sense of identity that might be lost if you made the change. But at the moment, a clear message was it's just really hard for the Cabinet Office to have that clear sense of identity for the very reasons that you say of having so many different things brought in.
I think the other thing is that, you know, what are the sort of enduring permanent capabilities, I would say, crisis response and the secretariat function in support of Cabinet government, and what are the temporary ones? And, you know, if you look over the last 4 years, you know, if the IFG had written a report like this 5 years ago, seven years ago, it wouldn't have said that the Cabinet Office needed to have a huge level of capability in European matters, but we ended up absorbing the Department for exiting the EU as well as the former Europe unit. It certainly wouldn't have said you need to have 380 people working in the COVID task force, because what's this COVID thing? You didn't have a permanent public pandemic response, certainly not in the Cabinet Office. So, a high level of contingency and ability at the centre to move your resource around and switch into the things that the situation requires, plus the kind of changes that are brought about by in a more purposeful way, such as obviously David Cameron intended, you know, to say, I want the National Security Council to be operating, and there's a structure in support of that, the NSS. Also post-Chilcot, it was a key recommendation there to have a substantial, well-resourced joint intelligence organisation operating independently from NSS. So those two have had lasting impacts on the shape and functions of the Cabinet Office.
I fear I could talk about our report for the rest of the event, so I'm not going to. Can we turn to the Civil Service People Survey?
Go for it.
We're really pleased to see the results of that published more quickly, as you agreed to do. Again, that was in response to maybe I'm going to do it anyway, but something that PACAC had recommended.
Yep.
But it did show overall officials' engagement and attachment to the civil service as an organisation falling for the third year in a row, which feels like it's becoming a trend. How can that be turned around?
I mean, if you go back to when the people surveys start, it's kind of like, you know, everything's gone up massively. And then, you know, we hit a peak actually in the COVID year, and then have fallen back 2 years since I'm out. So, but only by one percentage point in each of those things. The things that get measured there are particularly around your organisational loyalty and commitment to want to stay there. Those are the key things driving the engagement index. We've had a lot of movement. Cabin office, for example, I think 4.5 years is the average term for a cabinet officer official. So huge amount of change there. So right across government, that would be replicated. So that probably affects those figures a bit. Two things that trouble me most would be the scores in relation to pay and benefits and the scores in relation to leadership and managing change. The first of those fell pretty catastrophically in 22. They've recovered a fair bit in 23, but they still don't show, I would say, a strong picture. And I really worry about going back to the well of people's commitment and the obvious fabulous interest and value of public service, but I do think that pay has become a really serious issue. And the NEO report you saw published showed that every grade bar one, I think the most junior grade AA, all of the other grades over the last 10 years, the median wage has gone down in real terms and quite considerably in many cases. So that's a real problem issue, and the people survey is saying that's an issue, pay attention to it, oh leadership. So that's one. I think the other thing is that leadership and managing change, which is much more in our own power. It turns out, not surprising, that people have a certain capacity for change. And the absorption rate was, I think, exceeded in many cases in 22. 23 has shown a good recovery there. I hope you noticed the Cabinet Office was the top performing department and was up on all scores. have to use that opportunity to say so. But we put a big effort into that. But a lot of that was about engaging with people working in the Cabinet Office, about the purpose of their work, how we're organised for it, involving them in the change process. And people said they did feel very well, the quality of the communication leadership was much improved and much more visible, and they really appreciated that.
Okay. Are you worried by the drop-off in civil service fast stream applications, 45% across all schemes over the last 3 years?
There were a couple of factors that came into that. I think it was 3 years ago now when we actually paused the fast stream momentarily, so that would have affected the application rates that year due to a political decision made at that time. Secondly, we have been quite deliberately trying to adjust the balance of the fast stream towards more of a STEM subjects thing. And everybody comes to the fast stream now goes into a more specialised field. So we're kind of moving away from generalised, doesn't matter what your background is, and a bit more focused on the skills that you bring to it, and also then having slightly more specialised careers. That may be impacting the overall numbers. I haven't seen any signs at all that it's affecting the quality. And indeed, it would be a common observation of people in my generation. I joined the fast stream a very long time ago, many decades ago, that the quality of people is even higher, and it's really hard to get into, and I would like to apply now. So, it is a great scheme. It's a really popular scheme. It's regularly assessed as being, it's either number one or number two graduate scheme in the country. They've also become, I think, much better at inviting people from lots of different backgrounds, different communities across the country. It's a great scheme, and I don't have worries about that, actually, no.
You're not worried?
No. The only other issue is how many people realistically are going to have accelerated promotion to the top level of senior management. And there are some issues there, I think, about how big the SCS is, how big it's gone, and also the balance between internal promotions and external ones. But the fast stream scheme itself, I think, is in pretty good shape.
I mean, just because you mentioned the science focus, the drop-off in that area of applications has been 78% over 3 years. So
it's a very competitive market, but our aim was to try and get over 50% of the people who accepted offers from STEM backgrounds, and I think we had about 60% the first year we did that, and we're still over 50% this year, yeah.
And do you think pay is an issue there as well?
I'm imagining that pay is an issue there as well, yes. We have actually taken big steps to improve fast stream pay, and I think that will help, because we were concerned that there hadn't been an increase for, I think it's about 8 years, So we had a big process of ministers and they agreed to do that. We made big changes. Actually, I think it's a three-year change program, so that pay will be going up progressively. We've got two more years of that. For people working here in London, recognising the huge cost that people have in London, we also now do pay a London waiting, so I think that will help as well. The other aspect is just the speed of offer, because I think the data shows that people with STEM backgrounds are more likely to have more counter offers, which speaks to their immediate employability, not necessarily their long-term employability, and therefore being able to quickly turn someone's application into a straight offer. Your time to market there makes a big difference.
Yeah. As I recall, the process was quite long for the first stream back in the day.
It's very thorough.
It's much better now. Finally, just a question for me about overall staff numbers in the civil service. The latest numbers have full-time equivalents over 500,000 for the first time since 2007. Yep. The immediate cap on numbers that was announced in October, how do those two things compute?
I think the most important thing really is the cost and the sustainability of that. And that also we shouldn't only look at civil servants, we should look at public servants. So around about 500,000 civil servants, around about 5 million public servants. Those are actually quite fungible. You know, there are jobs that can be done by civil servants, the Ministry of Defence, and by armed forces. They're more expensive to be done by armed forces, but you can move those numbers around. That's true for all other departments as well. Plus, cost gets you thinking about, do you want this being done by civil servants at all, or would you prefer it to be done by consultants or contractors or other partners that you might have in civil society? So I think cost is your best guide to what you're trying to achieve. My view with that is that, of course, we should expect civil service numbers to fall, because like any other organisation, we're living through a kind of a digital revolution, and everybody should be able to use technology and data to be able to do the tasks they formerly had much more easily at lower cost and with higher levels of reliability. So that's the underlying reality, and that is improving things at this rate. Obviously, demand is also growing. People's population is growing. The number of people in need of public services, their expectations, the quality of public services are going up. So it's a race between those two things. Because I am relentlessly optimistic,
fortunately,
I think that the productivity and innovation will win out against the increasing demand and expectations. And with that, it will mean that people working in the civil service, everybody's job is going to become more valuable, because the output of their work would be greater. It doesn't matter whether you're working in customer services or case management or any other function you could have, or policy development. Anyone working in government should expect to be much more productive as a result of this technological revolution over the next few years. And that, I think, with the right investments, obviously, in digital infrastructure and training and everything else that goes with that, will enable the overall service quality to rise without the cost rising, and that will also improve the capability to pay people a more competitive wage. That's my optimistic view of how that will play out.
As you keep saying this, I keep hearing the voice of the PAC echoing in my head about civil service optimism bias. I want to move straight from that into one of the questions we've had online. We're going to come to questions, so everybody in the room, please have your questions ready, but it flows quite nicely in from what you're saying into just ask you to be perhaps a little bit more specific. Where do you see AI and advanced technologies improving public services, both in back office efficiencies, but also in terms of the public good on the front line? Can you be a bit more specific about where you see the biggest changes happening?
Yeah, very happily. So, I mean, the most important thing I get is in the more, if you like, routine type operations where you've got several tens of thousands of people doing basic administrative tasks, where a big part of the daily task is to put together information to present a picture about a particular case. It could be health related, it could be education related, it could be immigration related, lots of different types of cases we do. It could be businesses as well, people getting grants and so on like that. So all of that is case based. Assembling that information and coming up with a first up scoring of that information against preset criteria, I envisage that in time being better done by AI-enhanced machines. That won't take the people out of it, because the people then be involved in trying to make assessments on that, trying to make judgments on that, trying to manage the human interactions when they deliver those results to members of the public who are affected. But it will mean that the task of trying to get data together and to do an initial assessment will be made much easier for them by the power of the system they're working with. That's also going to be true of people in customer-facing roles, where enormous numbers of people, I think around about 1 million requests a year come into HMRC telephone lines asking for their NINO. Does everyone know what a NINO is, your national insurance number? Is that a good use of waiting online to get through to that number to ask something, a piece of data which you could have had been able to look up? A third of the calls that come into the student loans company are, what's the status of my application? Could we perhaps, you know, find a better way of dealing with that? And, you know, so I just, you know, I use these as examples. It's not great to be sitting there in HMRC answering the call saying your national insurance number is. That's not a particularly high value job. And it's not great to be waiting online to get through to that person to get that piece of information. So huge improvements, I think, in the quality of those. You know, these are not cutting edge things at all, but just being able to introduce technology available now, make it available to people across the civil service, is going to bring big gains in productivity and job quality as well.
Great. Okay, we'll get to some questions from the audience now. If you're in the room, we will have a microphone roving. Please do wait for the microphone to reach you before you begin your question. Do say who you are and what organisation you're from, and we'll try and take questions in groups if that's okay.
No problem.
You,
at all.
Alex? Stian.
Thank you, and thank you for that, Alex. That was fascinating. Stian Westlake from the Economic and Social Research Council. I wanted to ask about missions. Obviously, when you ran Bayes, you delivered a very successful industrial strategy focused around four grand challenges. At the moment, the PM has his five pledges to kind of bring together government. After the election, if the opposition is successful, we may have a set of five missions that Labour are talking about at the moment. What I'd just like to hear about from your perspective at the centre of the civil service, how can missions bring officials together across government? How have you found that as a tool to help galvanise the civil service?
Thanks. There's a gentleman on the aisle just here.
Gus Tugendhat, the founder of Tussle. I was wondering what you think the procurement-related challenges are awaiting an incoming government.
Thank you. And the gentleman here at the front.
Hi, I'm Matthew Trimming, Senior Advisor at Public. I had the privilege of working on Sir Alex's modernisation and reform work back in 2020, mm-hmm. When we did some work on innovation for you. I was struck by how closely you and Kat have worked over the years, and I think that is a very good piece of innovation, which hopefully will be continued. Just wanted to ask you a little bit about the role of, or maybe even the greater role of evaluation. I know that was a theme alongside innovation that you both spoke about at the December PAC.
Great. Happy to take those three questions. Thank you very much indeed. So, Stian, great question about missions. I think that it probably speaks to two sort of fundamental things. One is that as a narrative in politics, I think a sense of mission has been shown to be a winning narrative in many cases. So lots of different languages used around that, but some kind of mission thing is there. Try and say, what is it that if you elect me that you will get as a consequence that seems desirable? Missions are good. I think the second thing is that although we're organised quite vertically still with our government departments, the reality is that all the important stuff is now cross-cutting, and you kind enough to mention the industrial strategy. You could say the same about net zero, about levelling up, and also about big social problems. You want to deal with something like homelessness or recidivism, you know, that's going to be a joined-up effort between, you know, Home Office, DWP, Department for Health and Social Care, MOJ, etc. So, I think whatever administration we get next, they're likely to be, you know, putting an emphasis on that, as we have been in the last administrations. What are the challenges that come with that? I think that people actually quite like working in the civil service in that type of way. I think, you know, that's quite motivational. So I don't think there's issues there. The kind of old-fashioned idea of warring baronies, I don't really recognise that picture, so I don't think that's an issue. I think where there are difficulties are sometimes in aligning up resources against those missions, because resources are basically vertically done through the accounting office structure, and yet the big work is now cross-cutting like that. So trying to find a way to kind of endow people with sufficient resources to be able to see that mission through. And then the other thing, I think, is about your sort of marginal effort. If you think about the daily job jar or the weekly job jar, at some point, people have their kind of their internal kind of preference. They say, well, the person I mainly work for is X, you know, and the person I, if I've got the capacity, I will work for is Y. And I think that's a natural human trend, and it's sort of reinforced in a way by end-of-year assessments and things like that. So those are the two things to try and solve for, I suppose, incentive, you know, structures and endowment of resources. Gus's question, where's Gus? Gus, procurement, yeah. So risk of stating the obvious, the big challenge is going to be implementing the new Procurement Act, first new bit of government legislation in procurement in 40 years. And there's some really exciting capabilities within that act, particularly in terms of kind of like the, it's much more forward pipeline based, and that is different. People can be a little bit kind of, I'll put out my procurement when I'm ready, and this is much more saying this is what I anticipate needing in 3 years' time, which is really important for developing the opportunities for the supply chain. There's more scope to adjust the scoring around things like social value and things like that. It's also now pre-solved for the next crisis because it's got a better mechanism for kind of applying an override if you need to in a time of genuine emergency, and some defences against that. Basically, the if we're making direct awards, you have to enhance your transparency as a kind of compensating measure. So that would be probably the most important thing to focus on. I think something which isn't in the Procurement Act but is in the nature of procurement now is that old-fashioned procurement is kind of defining everything so exactly right and then saying, you know, having a competition, who can give us the lowest cost for delivering that exact thing. That is not really the world we're in now. We live in a digital world. We want to be working in a much more agile fashion. So what, you know, where you start and where you finish is going to be very different. So the idea of taking a lot of time to define something really precisely and then holding people to account through contract over a long period of time is kind of freezing people into an unchanging world, which seems a poor fit with the reality of a fast-changing world where the technology curve is still very steeply moving upwards. So that's the, you know, that's not from the legislation, that's more in the market and the context. And Matthew, finally, to your question about, first of all, you're right, I put great store by making common cause across the centre. Within the Cabinet Office, with our many different internal groups, including Number 10 within that, of course, but also absolutely working side by side, joined at the hip with the Treasury, made much easier by having such a brilliant colleague to work with as Kat. But that was very much a kind of a strategic issue as well, because we saw that in order to achieve lasting change, you needed to make sure the resources were aligned against that. And the Treasury, for their part, were also very conscious they're making decisions about how to give money to people. They needed to do that with a lot of expert professional input. And when we looked, for example, at in 21, the SR spending round, then £12 billion worth of bids came in from different parts of government, and we stripped out all the ones which were kind of like weak cases or duplications. There were 6 different digital identity systems bid for. We now have one login, it's very good, one login, important, rather than 6 login. So that was a bit, you know, big efficiency gain, but also, you know, putting all the different bids into a single stack, we ended up endowing £8 billion of those in a joint effort between Treasury and Cabinet Office. So I think one centre is really, really good. And also, when you're trying to work on major programmes, which is a joint effort with the Treasury, again, co-chair of MPRG, IPA, Cabinet Office, Treasury body, Public Sector Fraud Authority, Public Bodies Reform, all those are joint Cabinet Office and Treasury. So we've really pushed the one centre agenda, which I think is tremendously important, and that's more important than personalities. You know, Kat's a wonderful person to work with and do a great job taking over from me. But the more important thing is that the institutions, even if they're separate, work in unison. And finally, on your question about evaluation, I am madly enthusiastic about evaluation. I think it's one of the most important things you can do in government, because you don't just sort of hit and hope. what you want to try and do is to set out a case of what you think you'll achieve, do that, and see if you have achieved it, and if you don't, start over or make improvements to it. And again, because to my previous point, we're in a digital world, we can course correct quickly, we can continuously improve. We used not to be able to do that in the more analog world. So evaluation is your super tool to be able to do that. And we are now extending that practice right across the whole of civil service, but obviously we've got further to go there too. Thank you.
Great. I think we've got time for one more round of questions. I want to take this, the top ranked question from online from somebody called Liz. Why was it necessary to set an arbitrary figure for return to office rather than empowering departments to determine what works for them and their business needs? Mm-hmm. A couple more from in the room. The gentleman back there, Eddie.
Thank you very much. David Landsman from the D Group. I learnt a new word from the Cabinet Office, which I'm very grateful for. It was porosity. Yep. Interchange between civil service, the public sector, and the private sector. How's it going, and what are your aspirations for it?
Great.
Thanks. And there's a gentleman here at the front.
John Fitzpatrick, also from the Cabinet Office. Alex, if you had to identify what you're most proud of from your 4 years in Cabinet Office, what would it be?
You can slip right in this fiver later.
Okay. great question. So, first of all, Liz, online, so you're talking about the initiative we took last November to establish a going rate of 60% for office attendance. And you ask, you know, was that an arbitrary figure and why can't people decide for themselves? So, a couple of responses to that. First of all, it wasn't actually an arbitrary figure, it was quite a research figure. So we looked carefully at best practice across the wider economy in the UK, other countries, other comparable organisations. That was the most typical level we found. So we were quite modest about that. We didn't think we knew exactly what the answer was, but that was the most comparable figure. We knew that there had to be a balance because you've got individual people's preferences. Some people like to come in every day and some people would like not to come in at all. For good team working, for good collaboration, for good creativity, for good exchange of ideas, and importantly for training and knowledge transfer between people of different levels of experience, we know that office attendance is very important for that. So finding a kind of meet you in the middle figure is what we were trying to do. Could everyone find their own figure? Well, what we found there was that that kind of had been the approach before, and that was causing some problems, partly because that gave a sense in which individuals could decide for themselves, and some business unit heads, team leaders, felt disempowered by that when the needs of the business were clear, they needed people to come in. Also, I think the sense of equity and fairness, which I would say as an observation we tend to value especially highly as civil servants, people felt that was unfair that, you know, X was having to come in these days and Y wasn't able to. So having a going rate made that easier, especially bearing in mind that because of the regional hubs program we have, you've often got people from different departments working side by side in like areas, and people were drawing adverse comparisons between Department A and Department B in those places. So those are the main reasons which we came across, came up with the 60% as something which we debated very carefully across the civil service, all departments committed to that. And so far it seems to be going quite well. We do see that, you know, some people would prefer not to come to the office, and some people wish everyone's in the office every day. So we won't completely satisfy those people, but by having a going rate, making good use of our offices, trying to give a balance between the kind of the flexibility that people clearly value to be able to work from home some days, and then on other days coming into the office for the needs of the organisation, their wider team, 60% seems to an okay balance, and that's not surprising that that is the case because so many other organisations have found that too. So that may not be exactly the answer that you want, and I recognise that oftentimes I get asked that question by people who do not want to come into the office, but I won't presume that's your own position, but at least that gives you a sense of why we came up with a single figure across the civil service. I should say that that is for people who are office workers. Obviously, again, on the equity type issue, if you work in a benefits office, if you work at the border force, if you work in a prison, Your days are not 60%. You come into your place of work every day. Always very conscious of that as well. David Lansman on porosity. Yes, I don't think we've invented the word. I think it is actually a word, but I guess it's not a word that comes into everyday conversation. What does it describe? So what it describes is basically, I think, two or three things. First of all, a sense in which the civil service is not, contrary to the caricature sometimes presented in the media, an amorphous mass or a mandarinate or anything like that. It's actually an incredibly varied group of individuals and human beings with great skills. And we want to recognize that we need to get people coming into the civil service, bringing skills they've acquired elsewhere or knowledge sets, and sometimes just for a period of time. So you might do, in the American expression, a tour of duty. You might go on secondment. I went on secondment to the Department of Trade and Industry. I came back to the Department of Business 20 years later, so it took me a while, but I did in the end to get back there.
My temporary secondment to the IFG.
Exactly, indeed, yes. That I think is very healthy to have people moving in and out of government because they learn from their experiences outside, and government people then learn from their experiences in the wider economy. So that's the porosity concept. And I talked there about business, but that applies to academia, to people working in charities, etc. How's it going? Well, actually, pretty well. This has been quite a quiet success. So we were looking at the figures for the top 250 permanent secretaries and directors general. And you might say, well, of all the areas, that must be the hardest thing. You need to kind of understand the craft of working for ministers, parliament, all these other special traditions. 45% of those externally recruited, either directly or having come into the SCS and then being promoted from that role. So I think that is a much higher figure than it's ever been in the past, and so it speaks, I think, to our improving porosity. I've done my little bit of trying to contribute to that, so obviously working in the business department, CMA, the cabinet office, a lot of specialist functions, lots of people can come into those roles in the private sector, have appointed 12 directors general from outside in 11 years. Not saying it's a record, there could be, might stand for a bit anyway. So I really have tried to encourage that. And that is not because I don't think I have wonderful colleagues in civil service already. We have most people are internally promoted and they do so in open merit-based competition and do great jobs. But I do recognise that in a fast-changing world with incredible challenges we face, we do want to make sure that we're open to the town, to the whole country, because the work of government is so difficult and so important that everyone needs to get a chance of working at it, and we need the best of the best. So that's the porosity mission, and I think it's working pretty well, but obviously need to keep up the effort on that.
Can I just ask you, because we've done some work on this as well, as you know, what do you think the biggest remaining barriers are to be able to bring in that talent in the way you'd like?
I think job specificity is one thing. So if you look at the work, for example, of people who work on benefits, there is an external market in that, and it's called claims assessing, which is the biggest part of the insurance industry. But we see almost nobody moving between those two things, and that's because we define the work of people working on benefits in such a way that it seems completely different from claims assessing. And if you were working claims assessment, you wouldn't realize that was a job that you could do. Mm-hmm. So trying to make it easier for people for the jobs to be done by people externally. Also, I think that on the other side, we perhaps don't do as much as good a job as we could in formally adding to the skills of people working in the civil service with different qualifications at different stages and different accreditation for that. I'm very much in favour of that because that will help people then to go, when they go into the wider world, to get the benefit from all the things that they've learned from it, as opposed to saying that you're an X which means nothing in the wider world, or you've just got skills which you can talk to but you've got no external evidence of. So those will help with the porosity thing. It's so important also because I think that the concept of a job for life is going to be less and less typical. People are going to work for a few years. This is true right across the economy, not just the civil service, but we will not be immune from that. So porosity will become more important for that reason, as well as for the quality reasons that I described before. So most proud of, so many things, but I think the thing that is the most important is the response that was made to COVID. And I think, you know, the within that, the willingness that I saw from colleagues when the rest of the country were kind of, well, a whole country was facing, you know, a really fearful situation, enormous uncertainty, unprecedented challenges, to roll their sleeves up and work in a night and day under relentless pressure month after month to find working solutions and get ourselves out of a hole. And I think we did do that. And I think that was the supreme achievement. And I know lots of people were much more involved than I was in that. And you know, anyone working at the front line in the NHS, for example, you know, people, everyone in the country affected because of the impact on households. But I did, again, want to finish where I started with just paying a huge tribute to the civil servants across government who did amazing work in response to that, including colleagues in the Cabinet Office.
Thanks very much. Well, I think that's something we can all absolutely endorse. Unfortunately, that is all we have time for. I'd like to invite you all to join me in thanking Alex for joining us today, but can I also say thank you, Alex, to everything you have done for the civil service over your career.
Thank you, Hannah.
So if we could put our hands together.